The weather, to me, who lived for 15 years above the whatever it is parallel up in the far north, the weather is unseasonably mild. So I didn't notice for a while. But when the temperature dropped on Thursday night of the week before Thanksgiving, and the west wind pounded against the windows in my living room, I felt a draft blowing across my feet. I went to the window and discovered a breeze blowing through a space where the window was open. I hadn't opened it. And this being a new house with unusual windows, I didn't know how to close it. So I stuffed the cracks as well as I could with towels and hoped my Thanksgiving guest, who's very handy, would be able to fix it. The wind continued to howl against the panes and whistled even through the towels. I put on thick socks, a sweater, and my warmest, snuggly slippers. The changes in the seasons point out the ceaseless change of every day that we are lulled into ignoring until our faces are thrust into it or our feet are cold. Observed Robert Finch, "I grow old, I grow old," the garden says. "It is nearly October, the bean leaves grow paler, now lime, now yellow, now leprous, dissolving before my eyes. The pods curl and do not grow, turn limp and blacken. The potato vines wither, and the tubers huddle underground in their rough, weatherproof jackets, waiting to be dug. The last tomatoes open and split on the vine. It takes days for them to turn fully now, and a few of the green ones are beginning to fall off." Out my windows from my house, leaves are gathered into piles near the curb, while the last stubborn ones cling to bearing branches, leaving the skeletons of trees more and more exposed. Even early November is not returning. We are on the edge of winter, expecting snow any day now. The harvest and blooms are gone, and the time of cold sleep looms over us. Wrote Gerard Manley Hopkins, mentioning stooks, which means piles of harvested hay. Summer ends now. Now barbarous in beauty, the stooks arise around. Up above, what wind walks, what lovely behavior of silk sack clouds. Has wilder, willful waver meal drift molded ever and melted across such skies? This year, being on the edge of winter of deep sleep, is even more poignant to me, as I have just heard that one of my best friends is dying. She has a few months to live after the return of an old cancer. I am rearranging my schedule to go spend a few days with her. I don't want to believe that she will soon be gone. No longer will her wisdom break through my compulsions. No longer will she be there to laugh with, to fight with. She is very feisty and a great fighter. Her challenge is forcing me to clarify my own conclusions. She isn't gone yet, and I've already begun the process of grieving. Philosophically, it all reminds me of the Buddhist concept of dukkha. Dukkha means incapable of satisfying, clinging to impermanent states and things. The Buddha observed that life is filled with dukkha. It is unsatisfactory and painful. And that is what he meant by the phrase, life is suffering. It's one thing to speak of such esoteric things as dukkha. It's another to be facing the death of someone for whom you care. I don't think that my sorrow over the loss of my friend is a thing to be ashamed of, or to feel that this sorrow is a spiritual deficit on my part. When my mother died, a week after my birthday one fall, I didn't realize how much I was drowning. I just knew that I was lethargic, testy, always unsatisfied, and easily moved to tears. When this had lasted for over a year, a friend suggested that I see someone schooled in meditative healing. I trusted this friend's wisdom enough to try it. My mother had died of ovarian cancer. We had years to adjust to the idea, but her actual absence was not the same as knowing the absence would arrive. Every week I met with a meditation teacher, lying down on a soft mat in his meditation room, him taking me through the awareness of breaths, through relaxation, and into myself. After a time of silence, he would ask me, "What is happening?" Eventually, I realized that my mother was still with me in many ways. At times, I could feel her presence, so to speak. I'm not a believer in heaven and hell. I didn't and don't believe my mother is waiting out there somewhere for me to join her in an afterlife. But what I found is that I didn't have to wait. I have what I need to continue beyond grief. There are times when I still miss her to the point of hurting, but it doesn't cripple me. Instead, I'm comforted again and again. Again and yet again, I am able to let go and flow onward with the present moment and those to come. Dukkha is the first noble truth of Buddhism, that life in this mundane world is painful, unsatisfying, is suffering. It is the first of four truths that the Buddha taught to others after his own enlightenment. The second noble truth is Samudaya, that the origin or arising of dukkha is due to our thirst, our craving for and clinging to those impermanent states and things, leaving us trapped in renewed dissatisfaction. In other words, it is why we are soaked in dukkha, in suffering and dissatisfaction. We seem to always want the greener grass on the other side of the fence or the imagined golden age of the past. We want security through things and through controlling the world around us. We do it even though we know it doesn't get us what we want. If I visit my dying friend locked into what I am losing, I will miss the opportunity to be with her as she is that day. I will miss the earthly smell of autumn's chrysanthemums, the tang of an apple fresh off the tree after frost. At the University of Michigan, the College of Art, which I attended, used to be on the southern end of the main campus. Some of the classes I took were in a building on the north end of the campus, and the 15 minutes allowed between classes meant I had to step lively to make it on time. One November day, the skies were wild, the wind walking in gusts across the campus. I pushed and reset my course after each blow, arriving almost out of breath. A friend was standing by the building. "I hate these November winds," I said. He replied that only in the Midwest in November did the barbarous beauty of these willful clouds and winds arise. They were a particular beauty of this time and place. I pondered that statement long and hard before I could really appreciate such days. Now, when they come, I smile and watch with an eye not so much to their inconvenience as to their barbarous beauty. By letting go of the desire for continual sunny and calm weather, I am able to appreciate what is around me. Neither the Buddha nor I am proposing that we not love certain things or people or remember them when we die, when they die. But we must realize that love means loss, and loss tells us how much we have loved. Each year we have loved the summer with its harvests of food, its long lit days that allow playing into the evening hours. We have loved the lack of dangerous cold that can quickly take our lives or our fingers and toes. Who does not want to keep the fireflies forever in our presence? Well, if we can't keep the summer and our beloved ones will die, what should we do beyond the days of grief? Buddha's third and fourth noble truths speak to that. There can be an end to our suffering, he taught. When we stop all the clinging and craving, then nirvana can be attained, the state of complete peace. When we are in the state of complete peace, we are one with life itself in the reincarnation doctrine of Buddhism. This means that we will not return to the life of earthly separateness, the ideal of self, and all that that means. I also don't believe in reincarnation, but I do believe we can achieve a sort of peace with ourselves and with life. We do it through being able to let go and to be part of the whole of life, not clinging to its parts, which is part of the meaning of nirvana. Nirvana or enlightenment is available through learning to walk the middle way, the way of the Eightfold Path. I have over the years experienced moments of wholeness with life. It mostly happens to me when I am in the forest or next to a large body of water, where I realize that my part in the whole and my absorption into that whole. I cease to yearn. I am not dissatisfied. I don't feel inadequate. I don't feel separate from the whole of life. At times wandering in the forest, I have been in the company of deer who did not know of my presence. Standing stock still, I became one with their world. Suddenly, I am one with them and not a fearsome predator. Once, while sailing in the waters off the island of Maui, a whale rose from the deep and I looked right into its eye. I felt an almost incomprehensible connection. I was not separate from the depth of the sea, but partnered with it through the whale, partnered with a creature so very different from myself, yet also part of the larger life. That's what I discovered in the meditation mat in the presence of my teacher. My mind and heart are not separate from my mother, but always she is part of me. She travels with me. She has shaped part of who I am, and that never leaves. I don't have to grieve her or thirst for her. Buddha taught a way to nirvana called the Eightfold Path. Most of the teachings in it are the same or parallel to the teachings of our own faith. Buddha taught it as a middle way, a way not of being a monk nor being hedonistic, but a middle way between them. He gave to his disciples 8 ways of being that keep us from the extremes, and it includes the following in a very simplified version. Right attitude, not harboring thoughts of greed and anger which are born from our longing for safety and security. Right speech, avoiding lying, gossip, harsh speech, and tale-telling. Right action, not to destroy any life, to steal, or to commit adultery. Right livelihood, avoiding occupations that bring harm to oneself and to others. Right effort, earnestly doing one's best in the right direction. Right mindfulness, always being aware and attentive. Right concentration, making the mind steady and calm in order to realize the true nature of things. Right understanding, to understand the law of cause and effect and the Four Noble Truths. I believe each of you does these things or intends to do them all the time. One can take any religion or teaching into esoteric places, but this short version of Buddhism is common sense, a guideline most of us can accept and work to achieve. I'm not a person who believes it is enough to just change myself either. I need to work for space and opportunity for others to achieve these 8 paths to what I would call a fully mature life. And that is what the practice of justice making is all about. That and recognizing it when I see it happening in the many ways of the world's diverse people. But those are sermons for another day. Today, let us realize that the autumn points to change, dramatic change in a world that is constantly changing. How we adapt to that change, how we understand and step into its stream, can make all the difference. Amen.